Well, as you find your seats, brethren, turn to Ecclesiastes 7, where we're at verses 13 and 14. If you remember back in verse 8 of chapter 7, Solomon began to talk about, or he returned to the subject of God's sovereignty. And there he told us back in verse 8 that we're to be patient while we endure all manner of providences. We're not to grow frustrated, bitter, or angry. Verse 9, and we're to be content with our present lot and not look over our shoulder as if somehow yesteryear was far superior. Now he's going to return to that in verses 13 and 14 and speak of God's sovereign providence as his work. And we'll see that there in verse 13. And I want to consider verses 13 and 14 under these points. What does it mean to consider? That's going to be very quick. What work are we to consider? That too will be very quick. And then why? That will take up the remainder of our time. What does it mean to consider? What work are we to consider? And why are we to consider it? Ecclesiastes 7:13. Consider the work of God. 4. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider, surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. Now, these verses, I think, are rather straightforward and simple. It might take a few seconds for us to explain what crooked means, what work is here referred to, and in particular, what crooked means, and then the end of verse 14 is the most difficult. But the rest, I think, are rather straightforward. In fact, I think probably verse 13 is one of the most well-known verses in the whole book of Ecclesiastes and possibly the whole Old Testament. Furthermore, some of you might know, I meant to bring a copy, but I left it at home. In volume 4 of Boston's works, you have a set of sermons that he called A Crook in the Lot. And it's a wonderful treatise on verse 13 on the subject of God's sovereign, mysterious providence. And if you will talk about Boston, God willing, we'll get to the 18th century. But I said that Christopher Love was probably my favorite English Puritan, 17th century English Puritan. Boston's probably hands down my favorite figure in church history, period, in terms of benefiting from his writings. And this treatise he called, as a set of sermons, and he called it Crook in the Lot, because he understood that all of our lots, that is, all of our conditions in life, have crooks in them. C-R-O-O-K. Crooks. Not stealers or robbers or thieves. Sometimes we have those too. But he's talking about verse 13, and we're going to see that Solomon meant by being made crooked, hardships, afflictions, troubles, and difficulties. All of our lives are not straight. They're crooked. And God is the one that makes our lives straight and or crooked. And that's exactly what we find in this text. It's a great text, again, to illustrate God's sovereignty, and in particular with regards to afflictions. God sits as sovereign over our afflictions. He makes our lives crooked. This is what the text says. All right. But let's back up. What does it mean to consider? Well, it's easy to jump over words like this, but I suggest that we have to have at least some working understanding of the word here, consider, because we find it again in verse 14. But the word really means, the Hebrew word translated consider, means to inspect or give careful attention to. To consider. Perhaps one of the best synonyms I like is study. To consider is to ponder, inspect, observe, or give careful attention to. It refers to prolonged study. To continually look into or to thoroughly examine something. So, Solomon isn't just speaking about looking into it briefly or surfacely, but prolongedly and deeply. Consider, think about it, understand it, study, ponder. All right, these are basically all synonyms. But what work are we to consider? Secondly, well, he tells us to consider the work of God. And by work here is meant the work of God's providence. Now, let me remind you that we divide God's works into three. His work of creation, redemption, and providence. His work of creation, redemption, and providence. Now, there's two prongs to providence. Sustaining and governing. So, God is always working with reference to his providence in that he's sustaining all of creation and he's bringing all of history to his intended goal or purpose. And we know, as good Calvinists, that God has decreed all things to come to pass. Big things, good things, little things, bad things, all things. We find here the days, all of our lives are reduced to 2 days, prosperity and adversity. And God is the one who appoints them both. It really goes back to chapter 3. If you remember, there's a time for everything. And who is it that determines the times? Well, God does. Who is it that determines the days? God does. There's days of prosperity. There's days of adversity. Remember what Jesus said in John 5, my Father has been working until now, and I too have been working. And then they picked up stones to stone him because he was claiming to be God. The Jews knew full well what he meant when he said, as my Father is working, so I am working. They were both working to bring to pass redemption. But in particular, I think he's referring to that ongoing sustaining and governing work we call providence. The Father was working, the Son was working, the Spirit was working. Because remember, all the works of God are done by the Trinity. So the specific work that Solomon here refers to is God's providence. And I say that because of the next phrase that we'll get to in a second, in verse 13, as well as verse 14. I think you have the same thing back in Job 37:14. Remember Elihu? He said this to Job. Listen to this, O Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Now, that sounds very similar, doesn't it? Stand still. That is, quiet yourself. Gird up the loins of your mind. Calm your heart. And consider the wondrous works of God. Now, that's chapter 37. And then after that, you just have a wonderful exposition of God's mighty or wondrous works of providence. Listen to Mr. Gill. He said, Solomon advises us to consider the work of God, not the work of creation, but providence, which is the effect of divine sovereignty and is conducted and directed according to the counsel of his will. And it's always wisely done to answer the best ends and purposes. Everything is beautiful in its season. Contemplate, adore, admire the wisdom, power, and goodness of God displayed therein. It is such as cannot be made better, nor otherwise than it is. More simply put, Edwards Reynolds, diligently view and take notice in the course of the world of God's overruling providence. All right, so we're to consider, ponder, adore, look into, study, and marvel the work of God's providence. All right, now that brings us thirdly to why. Well, I can answer it in, first of all, examining the last half of 13, which is then elaborated in verse 14. Four. Here's why. Four. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Who can keep God from fulfilling his intended purposes? Nobody. all that God has decreed to do, he does do in his work of providence. And who could stay his hand and say to him, you're not allowed to do it? God does all that he wills in heaven, on earth, in the sea, and under it. Who can stop God from doing that which he's purposed to do? Or who can straighten what God has made crooked? Thus, by straight and crooked, Solomon isn't referring to things that are moral and immoral. The scripture does sometimes speak of crookedness in that way. But times that are easy and times that are hard, or in the words of verse 14, days of prosperity, that's straight days. Days of adversity, that's crooked days. Listen to Philip Ryken. When Solomon talks about something crooked, he isn't referring to something that is morally out of line, as if God could ever be the author of evil. Instead, he's talking about some trouble or difficulty in life that we wish could change but cannot alter. This happens to all of us. We struggle with the physical limitations of our bodies. We suffer the breakdown of personal and or family relationships. We have something that we wish we did not have, or do not have something that we wish we did. Sooner or later, there's something in life that we wish that God had a different shape to it. It's crooked as opposed to straight. Who can straighten that which God has made crooked? So by the day of prosperity is meant times when things are going well. Physically, financially, vocationally, relationally, and spiritually. By the day of adversity is meant times when things are not going so well, physically, financially, vocationally, relationally, and or spiritually. Again, Edward Reynolds. There are three primary realms wherein God's crooked providence may be seen. Now, I think I gave you, what, five? Physically, financially, vocationally, relationally, and spiritually. He's going to somewhat loosely boil these into three. He says, first of all, in the course of nature. In unseasonableness of winds and weather, in losses by sea or land, in sickness and infirmities or deformities, which God brings upon you or yours, nor at the miscarriage of any means or weakness of any endeavors you use to rectify things. Physical things, health, etc. Secondly, in civil policy and the managing of human societies. If you see great concussions in states, translations of kingdoms, plucking down and rooting up, the sword devouring as it pleases, wonder not, murmur not, but seriously consider that God has an overruling providence therein. And then thirdly, in the sins and prevailing wickednesses of men in any kind. When you see men persisting in wickedness so crooked that no means will reclaim or rectify them, consider the work of God's most righteous judgment in hardening those whom he will. So crooked is referring to times of adversity, difficult times or seasons. Verse 14 again, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. That is, rejoice and be glad. But in the days of adversity, consider. Here's our word again, and that's why I think when he tells us to consider in verse 13, he's speaking specifically of the fact that some days will be crooked, and God is the one that made them such. Because he says here in verse 14, consider, surely God has appointed the one as well as the other. God has decreed or determined the one as well as the other. Times of prosperity and adversity both come from God. God is the one who appoints seasons or times of prosperity. And when you experience them, or to the degree you experience them, rejoice. Receive them at God's hand. But, he says, consider this, in times of difficulty, remember God is the one who has appointed the one as well as the other, and he's appointed both of them for reasons that you need to learn. And I think that's in part why you're to study them. Study them to see the rationale, the benefits, the purposes. We kind of can know the benefits and purposes, or at least those are more readily discernible on the surface when we experience times of prosperity. But you have to dig a little deeper, I think, is what Solomon's saying. You have to study. You have to consider. Well, you should consider, yeah, when you get good things, God gave them to you for sure. But both times he says, consider 13 and 14, he's talking about times, crooked times, adverse times. Remember God has done that and think about it, learn from it, and you're going to find that there's actually just as much cause to rejoice in days of adversity as days of prosperity. And so fundamentally, I think, we're going to study times of adversity and see in such times the wise, sovereign, and loving hand of God. And I'll come back to that here in a second. Now, the final phrase of verse 14 is less clear, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. I think if you look over chapter 6 and verse 12b, remember that last question? Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Sounds very similar, doesn't it? I think it's an identical phrase. I think it means God's mysterious providence is such that no man can determine which day is coming. No man knows. You can obviously consider which day is upon you, days of prosperity or adversity, but no man knows tomorrow. Listen to Belcher. There's no guarantee that the wise will experience the good in the future. In fact, it's impossible to find out anything that will come in the future. Thus, a person should enjoy the good days when they come, because the future's uncertain. A person should also accept life as it is, because there's no way that it can be changed. So when good days come, or days of prosperity, rejoice and be thankful. But remember this, when days of prosperity give way to days of adversity, God is the one that's the cause of it, and there's nothing you can do about it. Now, again, I'm going to clarify that in a second, but that's basically what he's saying. Who can make straight? Can you? Can you make straight that which God has made crooked? Who can override his will? Who can go up to heaven and say, God, I'm done with it. I'm tired of it. Get out the way. I'm taking over. The audacity. Consider the fact that when happy days come, God gave them. When sad days come, he gave those too. Basically, is what we have. Now, by way of clarification, I don't think Solomon is saying that we're either going to have full days of prosperity or full days of adversity. So you wake up tomorrow, Thursday morning, and it's going to be a whole day of prosperity. The whole day is going to be good. You're going to hit every red light, not a yellow. Everything's going to work out perfect. And then the next day, it's going to be a day of adversity. And you're going to wake up, they're going to hit every red light, the car's going to break down, the dog's going to die, and everything else in between. Is that what he means? No. He just means time, season. There are prolonged seasons of prosperity and prolonged times of adversity for sure, but there's often seasons wherein there's a mixture of both. Good and bad have a tendency to kind of operate together. But there are days, there are seasons, there are times when things are harder than others, and other times when things are relatively easy. But either way, we're to receive both from the hand of God. Now, I made reference to Boston's treatise, A Crook in the Lot. He says this: everybody's lot in this world has some crook in it. Now, by lot, again, we speak of, well, that's your lot or my lot, our condition in this particular area or this particular area. Everybody's lot in this world has some crook in it. Complainers are apt to make odious comparisons. They look about and, taking a distant view of the condition of others, can discern nothing in it but what is straight and just to one's wish. Odious. That's an odious comparison, he says. To look over the fence into your neighbor's yard and think, wow, everything over there is so straight. He goes on to say, thus they pronounce their neighbor's lot wholly straight. But that is a false verdict. There is no perfection here. No lot out of heaven is without a crook. We all, yeah, we have seasons and times when there's everything's mostly straight, but everybody in this world, says Boston, has some crook too. I forgot to mention too, you may know, most of his children, as was common, died in their infancy or in their youth. Just a handful survived him. His wife fell prey to serious health problems and even mental problems, to the point where she even had to be restrained in a smaller home in his backyard. I mean, she would have been, you know, put into some type of mental institution today. Very, very sick lady. He had struggles. His life was largely that of adversity. But he had days of sunshine, too. If you read his 12th volume in his works, it's his memoirs, you'd almost think he never had a day of sunshine. Very gloomy guy. But if you have a life like that, you lose a child every other year. Your wife's locked up, restrained in some shack in the backyard. He's always involved in some ecclesiastical controversy because he was involved in that great controversy called the Merrill controversy. I mean, it'd be easy to be a little bit gloomy in one's memoirs. But nevertheless, you can read the treatise. Again, you can get them off this stuff off the internet. Just Google Boston, crook in the lot, and you'll get it for free. Read it. It's very helpful. It's just an exposition of this verse, verse 13. All right. What I want to do is give you a quick quotation from another commentary, and then I want to close with some broad observations. Times of prosperity are times of rejoicing. Times of adversity are times of teaching. And thus we have to receive both as the appointment of God. Those are going to be my two observations. Times of rejoicing or times of prosperity are times of rejoicing. Times of adversity are times of teaching. Because we're to consider, look into, quiet ourselves, and learn. And both are to be received as the appointment of God. Okay, listen to the contemporary commentator, Martin Helm. Solomon urges his audience to accept the Solomon urges his audience to accept the alternation of good and bad times in life as a divinely ordered reality to motivate them to enjoy the good times in life on one hand, while accepting without bitterness the inevitable difficult periods of life on the other hand. All right, so the first one will be very quick and the second one longer. First, times of prosperity are times of rejoicing. That is, we're to receive every good gift from above and as a cause for joy and gratitude. While this doesn't deny second causes, it simply recognizes every good gift comes down from above. Just like, for example, on Tuesdays, I didn't get it yesterday because of something, but normally every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, I get allergy shots. And I've been doing that for a year and a couple months. And that, along with possibly other things, other changes, have resulted in my sinuses being largely healed and recovered. In fact, I use a tissue maybe every 4 days, one or two tissues. When I was using one or two boxes a day for 20 years. Big difference. And I'm thankful to the people over at the allergy center. When I go there, I always tell them, thank you, ladies. The doctor, I'm so very thankful for what he's done in giving me that surgery and then in recommending the allergy shots and the modest medicines that I take. But ultimately, brethren, I trace back these good things, not to Dr. Bloomer and the nurses, though I give them credit, but ultimately to the hands of God. It's a day of prosperity, and it was a long day of adversity. And for that, I'm very thankful. And I'm thankful ultimately to God. It's a cause for me to rejoice and to obey out of gratitude. It ought to put wind in my sail. All right, let's look at this text, Deuteronomy. And notice verse 28, Deuteronomy 28, sorry, and verse 47. Now they're going to go into the land. He's really prophesying their exile. He tells them that if you disobey me, I'm going to put curses on you and take you into captivity. And notice here's one reason why this would happen, tragically. Deuteronomy 28:47, because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and gladness of heart for the abundance of everything. Brother, I really think it's rather easy to count our difficulties and overlook our blessings. Most of us, I mean, we all have our own adversities. But I think most of us would say we have a whole lot of prosperity. And sometimes if you don't count your many blessings, name them one by one, if you don't rejoice in the day of prosperity, God may choose to take away the straight and replace it with a crooked path. He took them away in part. Why? Because they refused to acknowledge the straight. They refused to acknowledge their blessings. They refused to serve God out of gratitude for all that he's done. Times of prosperity are times of rejoicing. All right, secondly, times of adversity are times of teaching. That is, God appoints them for our instruction, and thus we're told twice to consider or study such times. Now, I've already said this, but let me just underscore it. Solomon expressly tells us in times of prosperity to rejoice, but he doesn't tell us what to do in times of adversity other than consider. Consider. In times of adversity, that God is the author of the one in terms of his sovereign decree as well as the other. Now, I think the point being, as we receive days of adversity from God, we learn various things about God. So in one sense, I think it's implied that if we rightly consider days of adversity as from God, well, what's implied here is expressly stated elsewhere, as we'll see, we're to rejoice in those days as we rejoice in days of prosperity. That's kind of inferred here or implied here, isn't it, in Ecclesiastes? But I want to just show you very quickly from one text in Job, and then I'll move on to some particulars here. Look at the end of Job, verse 5, Job 42. Really, again, I've referenced the book of Job through Ecclesiastes so often, but they're really twins. You just find so many places in Ecclesiastes where Solomon is likely thinking of Job. Remember, Job was a very ancient figure. And a pious man like Solomon would have known all about him. Solomon's mama told him about Job, I'm sure, at their knees. And he says in verse 5, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. All right, let me just kind of remind you of the last 42 chapters. They were basically, well, it started out with a short day of prosperity, and then it quickly turned to a day of adversity, and it ended, it went all the way to the end like that. The whole book is one big day of adversity. And so he says, I knew you prior to the days of adversity. That's what he means. But notice now my eyes see you, or my eye sees you. In other words, I see you more clearly. I understand you more intimately. The days of adversity have taught me a variety of things. One, to close my mouth and trust you. We'll see that here in a second. But also I've come to see something of your incomprehensible glory. Days of adversity are professors, as much as, if not more than, days of prosperity. All right? Now, I want to say specifically, I said that as we receive days of adversity from God, as we receive them from God, looking into them, we learn some things about God, and I want to close by suggesting three. We learn about His sovereignty, wisdom, and love. We learn about His sovereignty. That is, we learn that no one can make straight what God has made crooked. Period. Your child dies. Your spouse dies. Ultimately, that comes from the hand of God. It's a crooked lot. I was calling a pastor from Colorado because I'm checking up on him for something with regards to the CBTS. He was a mentor. He was a pastor of a church in Colorado, and he mentored two students. So when he called me, I sent him an email, and he called, and we got talking about weather, you know. And then I asked him the question, tell me about your church, Jim, and what do you do there? Well, I'm no longer the pastor. There's two students there, but they don't have mentors now because I mentored both, and I resigned several months ago in the middle of last year because earlier in March of 2022, my wife tragically and suddenly died. And he didn't give me all the particulars about why that led him to resigning as the pastor. And even now he doesn't even go to that church. He said it was so difficult. He goes to a different church, and he's in the process of likely relocating to Boston, where his only married child lives with his two or three grandchildren. And I thought, Jim, do you mind me asking how old you are? 60. My wife was 57. She had a brain tumor. Was found towards the end of the previous year, and she died in the beginning of 22. And I thought, man, I started crying when I was talking to him, but I'm thinking, that sounds a whole lot like me, because I'm 55, going to be 56 next week, just a few years younger than him. I didn't ask him, but he went on to tell me he has five children. They're all my children's age, roughly speaking. So, I mean, our lives are so parallel. I'm just thinking, well, what if I end up 60 with him? That would be a crook in the lot. And he's having a hard time recovering from it because he was really just, you could tell he was put out. I mean, he resigned the pastorate, doesn't go to the church anymore. Not sure the particulars, but I suspect it was just too difficult for him to be there without his wife. That's what I suspected. Well, it just happened to be, I was thinking about Boston's crook in the lot. So I asked him if he ever heard of Boston. He didn't, but I explained to him the book, Hope He Gets It. And I was also giving him the gist of what I'm telling you from Ecclesiastes. Jim, that's a crooked lot. That's a crooked lot. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but Jim, the day of adversity, consider God appointed both. Do you remember what Job said at the beginning of his crooked lot? Chapter 2, 10, to his wife, when she said, curse God and die. He said, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? You're a foolish woman. You only want to receive at God's hands days of prosperity and curse Him if and when you receive days of adversity. So I think at the heart of this first lesson about God's sovereignty is the submission of our souls to His sovereign purpose. Period. Now let me clarify quickly. The reception of adversity from God doesn't mean we're not to seek to remove it if we can. Now, in the case of Jim, what can he do about it? He can do nothing. Well, I mean, he took her to the hospital. I'm sure they tried to treat the cancer, but she died. If your wife dies, or your child dies, your parent dies abruptly and quickly, what can you do but have a funeral and bury him or her? You can't change that. But if it was like something in my illustration, remember I had the bad sinuses. We had a surgery. We availed ourselves of lawful means. I get the shots, two in this arm, two in this one, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. And it's helping. And quite frankly, I'd do it for the rest of my life. if it continues to help. It's worth it every morning when I open up the canister of coffee beans to freshly grind them in my little grinder. And I open that thing up. Boy, that smells good. Didn't smell it for 19 years. So if you can alleviate the adversity, brethren, by all means, alleviate it. That's not wrong. Listen to Boston. By the way, Boston is such a theologian. He's by far my favorite guy because of the way he handles theology practically. He's like Christopher Love in that. He gets down, in the olden days, remember they dealt with hard issues, and he unties a ton of knots about sovereignty in this treatise. He says, first of all, let me see, quote 7. He says, it is very natural to desire to have the cross removed and to have matters in that part going according to our inclinations. And if that desire be kept in a due subordination to the will of God, it isn't sinful. Furthermore, if the means used to remove the cross, which is our crook, the attempt isn't sinful either, whether we succeed in the use of them or not. If the means used to remove the cross, which is our crook, is lawful, the attempt isn't sinful either, whether we succeed in the use of them or not. So the first lesson we learn is about God's sovereignty. And my first clarification is that doesn't deny the removal of the crook, if possible, with lawful means. But another clarification, then we'll move on quickly to our second lesson. The reception of adversity from God doesn't deny second causes. Go back again to Job. Remember, while the evil that Job received came from his enemies, the Chaldeans and Satan, it ultimately came from God. And thus he said, should we not receive both good and evil, or good and adversity? And remember, he said, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken. Thus, we must submit ourselves to every crooked lot as from God, regardless of second causes. Okay, so here I'm thinking of Boss. I'm going to quote him in a second. But, well, let me quote him first. Quote 9. But some will say, the crook in my lot is from the hand of the creature, and such a one too that I deserve no such treatment from. Okay, this is from somebody in the church who's mistreated me. Somebody in my family who's mistreated me. This is maybe somebody close to me, like my wife or my husband. Child or parent. Maybe it's my employer. And I'm being mistreated unjustly. The creature is the cause of it, he says. Answer. Although the crook in your lot be immediately from the creature's hand, yet it is immediately from the hand of God. So, yes, it comes indirectly, or let me see, it comes, how would I say that? It comes indirectly from your neighbor, but it ultimately comes for mostly or directly or ultimately from God's hand. He goes on to say, therefore, without all peradventure, God himself is your principal party, whoever be the last principal. So ultimately, it isn't them, though again, it's not wrong and it's even right to address things, to remove things lawfully. But ultimately, you have to remember that your problem doesn't come for mostly from them, but God is the one ultimately behind it. And albeit you have not deserved your crook at the hand of the instrument or instruments which God makes use of for your correction, you certainly deserve it at his hand. And he may make use of what instrument he wills in the matter. Or he may do it immediately by himself, even as seems good in his sight. He can do it either through second causes or directly. The point being is, irrespective if you're being mistreated at work for wicked reasons, unjust reasons, and yeah, you could pray for the conversion or the removal of your wretched boss, or maybe you might find a different job. But in the meanwhile, you have to understand that, yes, it is true, your boss is a wicked man, and he'll be accountable to God in the day of judgment for his wickedness. But ultimately, God is the one behind him, ultimately causing your lot to be crooked. And again, go back to Job. Job had every reason to blame everybody else. His wretched wife, Satan, and his enemies. And yet he understood that God was the one that was afflicting him, ultimately, as the first cause. We learn about his sovereignty and we submit ourselves to it. Secondly, we learn about his wisdom. That is how God is using adversity to conform us into the image of his Son. Remember the statement back in chapter 3, verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time. He's bringing everything to pass as he's decreed, and when he's done, it will be all beautiful. And that includes using days of prosperity as well as adversity. Sometimes God makes crooked makes things crooked, our lot crooked, as a chastisement for our sin, as was the case of David, remember. And other times, merely to purify us from remaining sin, as was the case of Job, if you remember. Remember, he said, when he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. And he hadn't done anything wrong, at least not like David. But Job was still a safe sinner. And he still had corruptions beneath the surface. And God made his lot, changed his lot from being straight. Boy, if anybody had it going on, it was Job. He made Job's lot go from straight to crooked rather quickly. And not just a little crooked, but a whole lot crooked. And he did so in order to what? Purify him. Now, here I want to turn into a text I referenced, James 1. And notice there's several texts, but you can imagine all the different texts that we could look at. But I think this will suffice. James 1, 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Maybe we could put it this way. My brethren, consider it all joy when you face days of adversity. And here's why. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Now that takes us back to last week's lesson. Remember, patience refers to patient endurance of hardship and affliction. So when God brings testings upon us, days of adversity, he does so in order to test our faith. That means temper it or strengthen it, which results in what? Patient endurance. And notice verse 4. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. We read today, I can't remember where, I think it was Jeremiah 8 in our Bible reading. And it had that famous phrase in it. Is there a balm in Gilead? And I just tell my wife about some of the gospel music. One in particular I'm listening to in my car now. I told her it was a cassette, but it's a CD. We upgraded several years ago. But it's a CD of a gospel singer. She was a Clark sister. There's an old group, the Clark Sisters. And she's one of my favorite cult. Her name is Karen. And Karen made the Clark sisters made famous the song, "There is a bomb in Gilead." I try not to sing it. Attempted to. Gilead was a place known for its medicinal bombs. It's a rhetorical question. The next phrase says, "Is there no physician in the land?" The answer is yes. There's both a balm in Gilead and a physician, and it's God. And so if you put a balm on a sore, on a sickness, it's going to hurt. But it's going to result in healing. And I think this is what James says. Knowing it has to have its perfect worth. Yes, the balm hurts. Yes, the day of adversity hurts. Jim, my dear former pastor friend from Colorado, I don't know fully, but I can assume that losing your wife at 60 hurts exceedingly. Because they probably had planned to live together for another 30 years. And now he's widowed. Well, just go back to our Sunday school lesson. Mrs. Love probably didn't think she's going to see her beloved husband beheaded on the scaffold. I mean, it probably wasn't in her thinking several years or maybe 6 months prior to that. That was our day of adversity. But it was also, in a sense, a day wherein God was putting a hurtful balm on an open wound. And albeit it hurt, it would produce, ultimately would produce healing and patience. Do you remember the account in 2 Corinthians 12? Remember there's the thorn in the flesh. This is actually a text that Boston brought up when he made the point that it's lawful to try to get rid of, it's lawful to try to get rid of the day of adversity. That Paul was asking that God would take it away. That's lawful. But God said, well, better than that, I'm going to leave the thorn in the flesh because it's going to, as a balm, produce good. And the good was it caused him to know his weakness and flee to Christ for strength. Remember, he said, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. In the day of adversity, you learn that you're weak and you find out that in Christ, there's strength. In fact, I skipped over a quotation from Boston. He gave these three directions for right managing the application for removing the crook in the lock. Pray for it. That's where the 2 Corinthians text came. Humble yourself beneath it as the yoke which the sovereign hand has laid upon you. So pray for its removal. Submit to it. Thirdly, wait on patiently to the hand that made it mend. What more can you do? All right, so let's go finally. We learn about his love. That is, adversity drives us away from the created and closer to the Creator. I really hope that's the case with Brother Jim. I really tried my best, brethren, to help him. He's a pastor. I'm sure he knows everything I told him. But sometimes you just need to hear the same things. What more can I tell you? I've long since tried to come up with something so creative that nobody's never, I never heard that. I just went on to tell him about Ecclesiastes 7, Boston's crook in the lot, and I did also tell him about Mary Love. I kind of gave him a 3-point sermon. The poor guy just endured it too, the whole time. God uses days of adversity as means to turn our hearts away from this world and its temporal joys. Days of adversity remind us that everything in this world is imperfect and unable to meet our deepest needs. Thus, we find throughout the book of Psalms, I have four or five of them, but we're not going to turn to them. You can almost turn to any psalm and find David taking refuge in God in times of trouble. Let me just think of this one. I'll paraphrase it in Psalm 142. David was actually in the cave, and he looked to his left and to his right, and there was no one that cared for him. That is, ultimately and perfectly, because he had people in the cave. We know that from the historical narrative. His parents were there. His little growing band of followers were there. There were people that cared for David, but nobody cared for David in the way that he needed it. Verse 5 says, "Then I look up to you." Father, we have, don't misunderstand this. Thankfully, we have creatures around us that love us. And in times of adversity, we are to look to them. Look to your wives, to your friends, to your pastors, to your parents, to your brother. Remember what the proverb says. That a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. That's why he's there to help you in the hard time. But here's my point. When you get right down to it, friends, earthly friends, are unable to ultimately meet the deepest needs of our souls. They can point us to the one who can, because Christ alone is that friend that sticks closer than a brother. Christ himself is our friend, born for adversity. Let me in closing remind you that our beloved's lot was crooked. If any man had a crooked lot, it was Jesus. And mind you, he never did anything. I said that David deserved most of his crookedness or his crooked lots. Remember, as a chastisement for his sin. Job, he didn't have anything on the surface, but he had something beneath it. Jesus didn't have any anywhere. And his was the worst. And he didn't grow bitter, remember last week, or angry, but he patiently endured it. In fact, we could say in one sense, his whole life was a day of adversity. And then his exaltation, a day of prosperity. He endured the one for the other. That's true too, isn't it? Yeah, we have days of prosperity now and adversity, for sure. But brethren, quite frankly, our days are basically that of adversity. Just levels of it, with joys intermixed throughout. But there's coming a time when all of our adversity shall be swallowed up in death, and there shall be anything other than one prolonged day of prosperity. But that's coming, and isn't yet. And it's coming because of Jesus' endurance of his day of adversity and earning for us that day, that happy day. That prolonged, unbroken day of prosperity. Amen.